Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. We continue our treasure hunt for solutions, talking with people who create solutions to seemingly impossible problems. Today we're talking about the challenge, how do we create a world that works for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time without harming the environment? This challenge was first expressed by Buckminster Fuller and has taken on an urgency today as we experience species extinction, climate change, growing use of toxins, and widening gaps between rich and poor within the United States and around the world. To meet the challenge of creating a world that works for everyone will require reinventing our economy in this generation. That's a tall order, but it is possible. And here to talk with us about how we meet this challenge is Gil Friend. Gil Friend is one of the founders of the sustainability business movement and was named an inaugural member of the Sustainability Hall of Fame, along with stars like Ray Anderson and Amory Lovins, and also named one of the 10 most influential sustainability voices in America by The Guardian. For more than 20 years, Gil has helped companies design, implement, and measure profitable sustainability strategies. He has advised a long list of impressive clients, including giants like Coca-Cola, eBay, Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, Hewlett-Packard, Levi Strauss, Nike, Odwalla, Pacific Gas and Electric, Raytheon, plus the City of Berkeley, and the U.S. General Services Administration, among many others. Gil is on the MBA faculty at Meridian University. Before being a business consultant, Gil served in the California Governor's Office, developing early sustainability policies and programs. He was co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a leading urban ecology and economic development think-and-do tank, where he pioneered the current green roof trend nearly 40 years ago. Gil recently accepted a position back in government as the Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Palo Alto, California, which lured him back to public service by challenging him to make Palo Alto the greenest city in America. He is a pragmatic visionary with broad and deep experience in both business and government that gives him a unique perspective on how we can reinvent our economy in one generation. Gil Friend, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Glad to be here.
So you are an eloquent speaker and a strategic thinker who has advised some of the most important businesses of our time, from eBay to Coca-Cola and Hewlett-Packard. Why did you decide to help companies be more sustainable? And what do you think is your greatest achievement in this area?
Well, why I decided to work with companies, I think, was put very well by Paul Hawken in the Ecology of Commerce 20-some-odd years ago. He said that's where the action is. When you look at the future of the planet, when you look at where the decisions are being made that impact the environment and human well-being, when you look at where the financial resources are concentrated and being allocated, that's where it is. It's businesses that have become the dominant institution in human civilization in our time. And as important as to work in other arenas ranging from community to government to politics, businesses are where the action is and where the leverage is, and where the change and innovation needs to happen. The opportunity here is that businesses, like most of us as individuals, are self-interested creatures. They're there to benefit their own purpose for being, and I want to talk about that a bit more a little bit later. But as anybody self-interested will do, the listeners can try this on for themselves. When you face an opportunity, one of the questions in your mind is, "What's in it for me?" And I saw the opportunity to re to reframe that question for businesses, as a lot of my colleagues have done, and to see environmental and social opportunity not as a cost, not as a distraction from purpose, not as something that would drain profit or cost business opportunity, but as something that could actually contribute to that, that could actually help companies build profit and build their brand and reduce their risk and be more successful as businesses by also being more successful as planetary citizens. So that's been the core of the work.
Fantastic. Brilliant. You know, I'm struck here. There was a recent story in the New York Times about a woman professor at Harvard who's done research showing that if companies pay more attention to the workers on the line who are actually interfacing with customers, that, you know, instead of seeing the employees as just another cost and therefore trying to limit the number of workers they have, to reverse it and see the workers as a potential profit center and an opportunity to increase profit. And with that shift now, you know, companies who are following that are getting some wonderful results, like IKEA. So, you know, I see a similar thing here. It's not just a sinkhole of expense for a company, but it's actually potentially an opportunity for profit making, certainly long term. So was that your experience when you were actually working with the companies? Did you find that what you were suggesting to them actually helped them be more profitable?
When they would implement it, yes. I think we're not exactly sure, but we think we've identified several billion dollars worth of economic value, certainly hundreds of millions of dollars of economic value for our clients over the years. Some of it they've executed on, some of it they have not. You know, it turns out that change is hard, even when somebody intends to do it. But there is a growing body of case studies of companies who have put hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to the bottom line through their sustainability and social enterprise efforts. So, you know, the assumption that is frankly still pervasive in the culture that this good stuff is going to cost me money is being refuted every day by the data, by the evidence, by the real practice on the ground from companies as diverse as, you know, Zappos and Interface Carpet and DuPont and Ford and others, as well as many smaller companies like Odwalla and Equal Exchange, and the growing population of cooperatively owned enterprises around the country.
Good, and I want to talk some more about some of those case studies in a minute, but before we dive into that, I want to ask you, you know, I saw a speech you gave last July, I believe, where you said, our challenge is to reinvent the industrial economy of the planet so it operates in harmony with the laws of nature that sustain it, which I thought was fantastic. Do you think we're kind of at a point now where we need to change the way we do business or we'll perish? And in any case, you know, how do you think we can reinvent the industrial economy so it is aligned with the laws of nature?
Well, there's a number of ways into this question, Eleanor. Let me first say what I mean by the laws of nature. The living systems on this planet, you know, what people call nature, I think of as ecosystems, have about 3.87 billion years, billions with a B, billions of years of experience in operating effectively, in being efficient and resilient and adaptive and productive. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. The R&D's already been done. The playbook is there. The R&D is, in fact, open source. It's not locked down in patents. It's available to all of us as the common knowledge and heritage of humanity as well as the other species on the planet. And these are things that we have, to a large extent, adapted to and operated within until the Industrial Revolution and of a few hundred years ago and the fossil fuel revolution of less than 200 years ago, when we've been able to, in effect, cheat. We've been able to operate outside those laws on a temporary basis, using highly concentrated energy sources that have been accumulated over hundreds of millions of years, and we're spending them in 100 or 150 years. But the basic way the game works here is that the planet operates on renewable income energy, the daily flux of energy coming in from the sun, which by current count, according to Don Aiken from Union of Concerned Scientists, is about 17,000 times as much energy as we need to run the human economy. So there's income energy rather than fossil energy. It's a system that's closed to material. There's no waste. All the material cycles. The waste of one organism becomes the food of the next. It's relatively flat in its information interaction infrastructures, or what we would call as humans decision infrastructures. And it's highly diverse. And these four points and a few others become the template for how to start thinking about industrial society, to move from what Ray Anderson, the founder of Interface, called the take-make-waste system, where, you know, in his business, he would a company would extract petroleum from the ground, turn it into nylon, Ray's company would make it into carpet, the carpet would go on the floor of an office, live there for 6 years before it's torn out and replaced, and then spend 20,000 years in a landfill decomposing. Seemed to him to be a crazy way to do things once he finally understood that, and he launched a project, which Interface is now 20 years into, to reinvent the company from a take-make-waste linear processing system into a circular system where nothing goes to landfill, where the factories have no smokestacks, where they have no sewer pipes. Because, see, from a business point of view, not just from an environmental point of view, from a business point of view, waste makes no sense. What we call waste, I always use the word in quotes because I think there's no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
What we call waste is material that's out of place.
Mm-hmm.
But from a company's point of view, it's raw materials that they have bought and paid for, that they've spent money on factories to process it and on labor to process it, and some of it goes out in a package on a truck to a customer. And the rest of it goes out a smokestack or down a sewer pipe or to a landfill. For the U.S. as a whole, what would you think that balance is between the stuff that becomes product and the stuff that becomes what we call non-product?
Well, we would hope that it would be like 80% product and 20% waste.
And 80-20 is always a good answer to any question when you don't know the answer. But in this case, it's not. It's 6% and 94%.
6%? Productive use
on a mass basis,
God.
And 94% not
oh
on a mass
God.
Basis. Oh, my God. And that's what CEOs say when we show them the data for their companies. But here's the thing. Then the smart folks look at that and say, well, wait a minute, that makes no sense. We should stop doing that. Interface, Odwalla, and others took that as an instruction to say, well, we need to invent a zero waste company, or put it another way, a 100% product company. Make nothing that we can't sell or find some productive use for, as would happen in living systems. In the case of Interface, their efforts in that direction put $450 million to the bottom line over the past, I think, 10 or 12 years, about equivalent to the company's total profit.
Wait a minute. You're saying that Interface used this whole approach of kind of going mm-hmm. whole systems with mm-hmm. no waste, and in doing that, they like doubled their profits by $450 million?
This has been their guiding star since the mid-1990s. They're not all the way there yet by any means. I think by their measures, they're about half or two-thirds of the way there.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't double their profits because this was during a period where the whole carpet industry went through downturn. They wouldn't have had any profit if they hadn't have done this.
Holy cow. So they might have even gone out of business.
Instead of going out of business,
they
made... It's a multi-billion-dollar company.
Instead of going out of business, they made $450 million?
And took industry leadership.
Awesome.
And, by the way, do they have industry leadership? Debatable. Shaw, one of their competitors, will say, we're doing a better job at eco-sustainable carpet business than Interface is. Companies in that industry are now competing to see who can be greener and more effective.
That's the competition we want.
The competition we want, and it ripples through the business system, because when you look at the world of buildings, where we now have a green building rating system for the last 20 years called LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, which became an expected standard for federal buildings in the 1990s. Many states and city governments require LEED certification in their own buildings and in buildings being built within their jurisdiction. Well, that then means that architects have to design buildings that meet those standards, which means that architects have to find materials that are suitable to those standards, which creates a demand for example, for carpeting that is recyclable, carpet adhesives that are not toxic, building materials that perform more effectively. All these things start to create demand and drivers for innovation and drivers for jobs and employment and economic growth rippling through the entire economy.
Wow, so is this like Exhibit A when you talk to companies and say, look what Interface did and maybe we can do the same or similar thing for you and your industry?
Exhibit A is to look at what are the flows of material through your own company and where do your processes add value and where is value leaking from your business by going, for example, to a landfill or out of smokestack instead of into a product. Exhibit A is building that is getting at that ratio of product to non-product for a particular company and sitting down and saying, okay, now what do you want to do about this? I think Exhibit A is conceptual, and then Exhibit B is here's examples of what other companies have done with that. And then the question is, well, what do you want to do with that?
Yeah, you know, this really struck me many years ago when I was doing some work for the state government of Massachusetts. I was looking for these models of who's being more ecologically sound. Mm-hmm. And there was a great trophy company down in the Fall River area, Massachusetts. And the owner was going out of his mind with the increasing regulations that got more and more strict with the amount of polluted water, because he would take the water out of the town system and then use it to make the trophies, and then he'd dump out the water on the other end, and it would be full of all kinds of toxins because of the processes he used.
Yeah.
We're talking like hundreds of thousands of gallons that he'd be emitting every year. Mm-hmm. And he said to his wife, you know, I'm just done with all these government regulations. We're moving to some other place. And his wife said, you know, our children are in school here and we're not moving. You figure out how to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
So with kind of that ultimatum, he got some guidance and he went into a closed water system where he takes water in from the town, makes his trophies, and then actually, you know, doesn't pollute the water, because what little water does come back out, because it usually now just keeps getting circulated and filtered, what little water does come out is cleaner than the town water that comes in.
How about that? So the factory becomes a filter for the water instead of a polluter of the water.
Exactly.
And I bet he's making money doing that.
He's making a lot of money doing that.
So here's the other competition. You have some folks who are saying, I can't possibly run my business producing clean water because it would cost me profit. I'd go out of business. I'm going to fail. And you have people like this person saying, I can do this smarter than other people and develop a better system that is more productive and more profitable and provides a public benefit of clean water rather than a public harm of dirty water.
That is awesome.
So there's a big shift happens in people's brains to enable that to happen. And yes, you need the evidence and you need the how-to, and there's technology, you know, there's serious technology innovation that has to be done to do that. But the core is that shift in attitude, in mental model, if you will, about what's possible and what's right and what's necessary. And that's why I keep going back to living systems, because there we see systems that are self-maintaining and self-purifying.
Mm-hmm.
Driven by the sun and the winds, which are driven by the sun, and the tides, which are in themselves driven by the sun. You know, Ken Boulding said years ago, existence is proof of the possible. Existence is proof of the possible. One, if you can show me something that is working, you can't tell me anymore that's not possible to do, because there's at least one case where it works.
Yeah, you know,
a question of possible or impossible. It's a question of how do I take this and apply that in my situation.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, I have a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt. I don't know who said it first, her or Ken Boulding, but she said, if it exists, it's possible.
And basically the same quote. Yeah,
same quote. So it's a profound truth. And I think you're right. You know, if the people who are running the companies can shift in the mental model and get out of feeling resistance to whatever latest government regulation is coming, which is kind of the bare minimum to keep going, and get ahead of the curve and just say, you know what, let's assess our system, our whole system, and let's see what we're using and see how we might change this. You know, I went to another factory in Massachusetts, my favorite. It was an ice cream factory, and it was one that was about to go out of business, and then they started to measure everything, you know, measure all their elements, measuring their electricity, mm-hmm. as what, just like they would measure the dairy products that go into the ice
cream. Sure.
And once they started measuring, they went, holy cow, we are chewing up a lot of energy. It was a big cost. So they did some systems changes which enabled them to make as good, if not better, ice cream with way less electricity use.
Yeah, exactly right. And then if you take the additional step of, you know, track your own resource use, but then compare that to others in your industry mm-hmm. or other factories in your company if you're multi-factory, and compare how are we doing compared to others. That's another place where this existence as proof of the possible comes in, because, you know, I may think in my factory that I'm doing a good job. I've cut my energy use 10% or 20%. We're improving. We're making progress. Subtext, we think we're doing as well as can be done. But then if I get a look at your numbers and see that you've cut your energy use 40 or 50 or 60%, holy mackerel, mm-hmm. then I know my work's not done. Then if you, third step, if you take that and make that data available in real time to the people who work in the organization, so that the, you know, everybody from the chief financial officer to the guys and gals on the manufacturing line can see that data, they will start to think differently, and they'll start to identify innovation opportunities. A colleague of mine, Jan Hanhart, did this in an industrial factory in Holland some decades ago. He put up giant posters on the walls in the production lines showing the productivity rate and the defect rate in the factory. Charts that any good factory has, but they're typically on a wall in a hallway near the break room. He put it up so that everybody on the production line saw it every day. He pointedly did not explain himself. He did not set any goals. He did not train people. And he didn't provide any financial incentives for doing better, which is the usual tool that managers go to. He just provided the information and kept it up to date and found that over the course of the next couple of months, productivity went up, defects went down, absenteeism went down.
Oh.
All because human beings were trusted that if they had good information in context, they would do better. And they did. And we see that happen again and again and again. In fact, we think that providing people a clear line of sight that connects their actions and their expectations or aspirations or what's expected of them with the impacts of with the impact of those actions, that's one of the most powerful change tools there is. And it works at the level of a factory, as I've been describing. It works at the level of individual householders with their electrical bills. You have companies like O-Power that are providing that kind of performance comparison, performance benchmarking onto people's utility bills in cities all around the country, including Palo Alto. You have the opportunity, which we haven't seen done very well yet, but would love to pilot in Palo Alto and in the Bay Area, to create a kind of a regional performance benchmarking so we can see how each city is doing compared to the others around. And we can use that as kind of a collaborative competition to learn from each other and ratchet up all our performance together.
That's awesome.
By the way, we know this works because we have sports, and sports has scoreboards and league rankings.
Yes, well, you're
competition,
talking...
And competition to do better. And we can take that proven technology that actually, you know, engages and delights billions of people.
Yes.
And use it on the planetary challenge as well.
Including me. I mean, you're talking to the governor of Red Sox Nation for Washington, D.C. I love baseball. So
yeah.
Anything with sports is good with me.
Yeah.
You know, I love the tagline you've had in your sustainable business consulting firm, you know, reinventing the economy of an entire planet, this planet in one generation.
Yep.
It's just so inspiring. What a call. And I'm wondering, you know, you've been doing this consulting for business for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and you were doing government work and advocacy work before that. Looking back over it all now, where do you think we have made the most progress, and where do you think we still have the biggest challenges in front of us?
Oh, golly. Well, We're going to need more than an hour to handle this one.
We can do a follow-up show.
Yeah. So I don't know about the most, but let me give you a few places where we've made progress. Certainly the renewables revolution has been a big one. The price of renewable energy has been dropping rapidly. Photovoltaic electricity, solar electricity is at grid parity, is competitive with fossil fuel and nuclear sources in many parts of the United States already, and will be that increasingly in the next few years. That's really shifted the economic choices that people face. And, you know, what used to have to be a dedicated, you know, passionate decision to spend more money to make an environmental statement is increasingly becoming just a good, clear, sensible economic decision. City of Palo Alto, where I now have the honor of serving, has a municipal utility company. It's a city-owned company that provides electricity and natural gas and water and wastewater treatment. We, as of 2013, are delivering 100% carbon neutral electricity.
Wow.
Some of that is through offsets, so we're not all the way there. In 2014, it will be 100% renewable, 100% carbon neutral without offsets. And our electricity prices are lower than the prices from the, you know, commercially investor-owned utility in the region.
Wow.
With careful thinking and sound planning, renewables making economic sense is one place where I think we have a big victory. The coal industry is on the decline. The nuclear industry is on the decline. That shift is in motion. It's taken a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not done, but I think that's one place where there's been great success. I think in the policy arena, the shift from pollution control and regulation to pollution prevention, this is going back into the 1970s and 80s now,
mm-hmm.
Was a big one, to say instead of government telling somebody how to run their company, which is, you know, government's not great at and businesses don't like,
mm-hmm.
We could instead shift to a performance-based regulation and say, here, we're going to tell you how much you can emit from your factory into the town's water, to use the example you talked about before.
Right.
And we'll encourage you and help you to find ways to improve your processes to prevent that pollution in the first place, rather than figure out how to treat it once it's been created. We all know ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. That applies in business also. So I think that's a second place. Emerging opportunity that I've been paying a lot of attention to over the years, and I think really pivotal to this whole transition, is what I call getting the prices right, is how we can shift our accounting tools and our economic tools and our tax and finance tools to more accurately understand and reflect the real costs of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We have an economy that operates on enormous hidden subsidies. Some of those are direct subsidies, like actual, you know, government payments to industry reduced costs. I'm thinking of mining on federal lands. Companies are paying land rents that were set in the 19th century. So that, in effect, is a taxpayer subsidy to an industry. Now, you know, you can argue there are reasons to do that. I would say that if it's a, 140-year-old subsidy, it might be time to reevaluate it. Maybe conditions have changed. Maybe the economic impetus that drove that is no longer the case. But, you know, so there you've got a public subsidy to an industry. We have industries where there are direct taxpayer payments to industries. But we also have the unmonetized externalities, the cost that nobody is paying for. Think about pollution. Think about damage to think about something as simple as laundry costs when you have dirty clothes from air pollution. But think also about the cost of the military budget to keep the supply lanes open to the Persian Gulf to bring oil in to the United
right.
States. So you add all that stuff up, and you know, no one knows the exact number, but the estimates are on the order of $500 billion to $1 trillion a year in subsidies to the energy industry.
So we still have a lot of work to do. We're going to need to take a break now. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Gil Friend, a leader in the sustainability revolution, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Gil Friend, a leader in the sustainability revolution. Gil, just before the break, you were talking about some of the amazing advances made in business when they do start to kind of measure what they're doing and go whole systems and, you know, shift the amount of waste, which there should be none of. We could design it that way. You know, from your experience, how open are businesses to becoming more ecologically sound? You know, you're laying out the benefits. You'd think every company would be jumping at this. So why don't more businesses do it? What are the barriers, and how can those barriers be overcome?
Well, Eleanor, a lot are doing it and more all the time. I think there's really been an acceleration in this trend in the last 5 or 8 years, marked probably more than anything else in my mind by moves in 2005 by two companies that may not be all that popular with your listeners, but that had a big impact. General Electric, the industrial giant, started their Eco-Imagination program. In the words of their CEO, Jeff Immelt, he said, look, green is green, meaning that environmental is profitable. And they have been rippling sustainable design through many of the hundreds of businesses that they run, generating tens of billions of dollars in new revenue and some remarkable technical innovation. Same year, Walmart announced their sustainability program. And without getting into the issues of labor practices and other concerns that people have with Walmart, what they did do is they said to then 60,000 suppliers, now 100,000 or so suppliers, they said, look, Walmart is committed to going to 100% renewable energy, zero waste, and selling only sustainable products.
They did not say that.
They did say that.
And do they mean it?
As far as we can tell, yes.
Wow.
Although it's complicated to move a big beast, and there's forward and back, but they started pulling together major suppliers. We got Naturalogic, the company I was running at the time, started getting calls from Walmart suppliers saying, listen, we got two questions. First of all, what the bleep does sustainable products mean?
Yep.
Because they hadn't even heard the term before. And second, what do we do? How do we do that? Because our shelf space in the largest retailer in the world is now going to depend on whether we do that or not.
Wow.
And so in one fell swoop, one statement from one company had more impact in boardrooms across the United States, probably across the world, than any action EPA ever took.
Wow.
And I don't say that to disparage EPA. It's a critical organization also. But, you know, this really focused the minds and businesses around the world. That's, I think, one thing. The other is that as more and more companies are building some experience in the cases that we talked about before, like Interface and DuPont and others that are making money from this, and as a younger generation moves into leadership in global organizations who have grown up in these issues and who have these concerns and now have their hands on the levers, and have had some exposure to this kind of thinking, you're seeing a vast range of experimentation. So now, for example, you know, we used to talk about making more energy-efficient homes. We talked about having renewable energy-powered homes. Well, now in California 2020, it's going to be required that all new homes be zero net energy.
Fantastic.
Meaning they will require no energy from the grid to operate, meaning they'll be efficient enough and harvest enough energy from sun and wind and other resources they can run themselves. City of Berkeley, where I live, just opened a zero net energy library last month. You know, there's no heating system. There's no fans and motors. There's sunlight and skylights and intelligent building design and intelligent controls. One of my colleagues, Peter Rumsey, who heads the Integral Group and Engineering and Design Group here in the Bay Area, has so far built 41 net zero energy projects, ranging from houses to foundation headquarters to community of 2,500 people. So there's your proof of the possible. And I asked him, Peter, how much more did these cost? Because that's always the concern. How much extra do I have to spend to get the eco-groovier thing? He smiled and he said, nothing. No incremental cost. Smarter design delivered a phenomenally better result at no increased capital cost. And if anybody's got their calculators out, tell me what the percentage return on investment is from eliminating energy expenses at no capital cost. It's an insanely impossible question to ask. You can't divide by zero.
Right. It's infinity.
So is that a good investment? So, you know, if you're environmentally oriented, it's obviously a good investment. If you care only about making money, it's a good investment. In fact, you get to do both.
Yeah, unless you're Pacific Gas and Electric or the company that's been making money off of it, right? What's happening, there's always someone's going to have a downside.
Well, Pacific Gas and Electric is an interesting example of maybe not a downside. I think, yes, you know, traditional utility company may be problematic, certainly if you're in the coal business or the oil business. There's disruption in your future. But, you know, PG&E 40 years ago now, PG&E and the California and Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric, the three investor-owned utilities in California, and the California Energy Commission and the Public Utilities Commission and the Natural Resources Defense Council, the big environmental organization, got together and redesigned the regulatory system for utilities in California and moved the model from the old model, which had been, we'll guarantee you a specified rate of profit per dollar of capital investment, which is how most utility regulatory schemes work, which, as you, if you just think for a moment in your mind, provides a financial incentive for building more power plants.
Right, and encouraging people to consume energy.
Well, no, the incentive to the company, yes, is to build more power plants, and then you have to sell the electricity. So, you encourage more consumption, which builds demand for more power plants. You build more power plants, you make more money. Simple. Makes a lot of sense. That's what the scheme is in most places. Here in California, we turned that on its head, and we said, instead of incentivizing for production, let's incentivize for efficiency. And instead of only allowing utility companies to capitalize the power plants, let's enable them to capitalize their investments in efficiency. So now the PG&E could pay for the insulation in my home and make money on that. I pay a lower energy bill. They make money through the rate structure that the state has established, the regulatory system, and the incentive has changed. And the net result of that, if you look at electricity use in the United States over the last 40 years, per capita, it's doubled across the United States in the last 40 years. In California, it has stayed flat.
That is awesome. And we can hope, you know, as so often is the case, as in California, then follows the United States. What incredible models you've succeeded in creating there.
It's really exciting here, and that's one of the reasons that I've made the move that I've made to Palo Alto.
Very good, very good. You know, I do want to ask, you know, some of your corporate clients are not what one generally thinks of as eager to go green, like the big defense company Raytheon.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do for Raytheon, and how was your advice received there, and what impact do you think you've had there?
Raytheon came to us, and they came and they said, our customer. It's funny, you know, most companies talk about their customers.
Mm-hmm.
Raytheon said, our customer, meaning the Department of Defense, has said to us that they want sustainable products. Defense Department is very concerned about sustainability as a global strategic issue as well as an operational issue. And they said to Raytheon, or they said to all the defense contractors, we now have a new list of things we care about. You guys got to get up to speed on this. Raytheon came to us and said, how do we train 18,000 engineers to think differently about design?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the fact that it's Raytheon is distinctive, but that's the question that's being asked at companies ranging from, you know, Ford to General Mills. How do we train our people to think differently so that they can ask different questions, so they can see different opportunities, so they can bring different success factors into the design of what we create and how we operate so that we can be effective and successful and competitive and profitable in this new economy that's emerging. Some of it's at the level of design. Some of it's at the level of radical business model innovation. So you see something like Zipcar as, you know, one of probably a dozen examples now of car sharing companies that let me have access to a car without owning a car in a city. Fascinating business model, but a big challenge to Detroit. Because if we can share cars, we don't need to all own cars, and then the country can operate with 1/11th or 1/12th the number of cars that we have now. What happens to Detroit? Well, Ford, probably the most forward-looking of the American auto manufacturers, partnered with Zipcar several years ago. Bill Ford, the chairman and CEO of Ford, said some time ago, he said, look, you know, we're not really a car and truck manufacturing company.
We're a transportation company.
We're a mobility company. It was mm-hmm. the word he used, but exactly that. And so the question that he's challenging his organization with is, how do we provide a valuable contribution to society and make money in a world in which we might be building fewer cars and trucks, not more? Very challenging and very powerful opening for innovation.
Yes, and good for Bill Ford for getting ahead of the curve on that one.
Yes, indeed.
So I want to ask you, you know, we're talking about a big system shift here, and the way you're talking is you're talking about companies thinking in terms of whole systems. How have you used systems thinking in your own work?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's so innate that it's hard to answer the question. It's sort of where I come from into any situation is that I look for the connections between things. I look at the relationships between elements in an organization or in a supply chain or in a business system. I look for the patterns and the trends in those patterns. I look for what's missing. You know, again, we've got another call to do here because there's some fairly systematic methodology that we could talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps at a simplest level, we'll start with a question that someone's asking or the problem they're looking at, and we'll zoom out and say, what is the system that problem is embedded within?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so not just what's wrong with my telephone, but what's wrong with the telephone network that this phone is operating as, the problem in the box on my desk, or is the problem in the wires or in the switching station down the hall. Or is the problem in the way we're communicating in this company?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll ask the question of what are we trying to accomplish here? What are we really trying to do? And is what we're doing the best way to do it? So there, again, back to Ford. You know, if we're in the business of selling cars and trucks, we're going to do one thing. If we're in the business of helping people get to where they want to get to, we might do it in a completely different way.
Right. And, you know, kind of along with that, there's been some important work done in creating frameworks that help people to think and to manage systemically, like mm-hmm. the natural step. And I understand you've used the natural step some. And do you think that's a good framework, or what frameworks do you think are effective in helping companies to shift?
Well, there are many. The natural step is one of my personal favorites. It came out of Sweden in the early 1990s. It has the power of being very simple and science-based, and I like to say it's something that a CEO can understand and a third grader can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's provided a very simple guidance system that has been adopted by hundreds of companies and hundreds of municipalities around the world. Nice thing about the natural step is that it's like a knife, like a warm knife through butter. It just cuts through political disagreements and cultural disagreements and age disagreements. You know, it's like, you know, you come down to certain bedrock science that nobody can argue with.
Can we use it in Congress?
Congress is challenging these days, isn't it?
One step at a time. You're working on the business piece now.
Well, working on the business piece, but also working on the municipal piece, because with Congress in logjam, as it has been for, what, you know, more than a decade,
yes.
Really, a lot of the action on climate and sustainability at the policy level in the United States is at the states and the cities.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about the California energy policy example before. We've seen cities like San Francisco, which have been phenomenal leaders in procurement-driven sustainability. San Francisco, budget of about $7 billion, I believe. Gavin Newsom, the former mayor, said we spend about $1 billion of that on buying stuff. What if we bought stuff that was cooler and greener?
Mm-hmm.
How hard is it to do that, he said? Well, it's as hard as a stroke of a pen. I sign an executive order, and we are now buying 100% recycled content paper or hybrid vehicles or LEED silver buildings or, you know, organic food or whatever it is. And that then starts to create a market which provides business for local enterprises and jobs for local people and improves the economy of scale of what are initially, you know, sort of fringe or niche kind of efforts, and takes things like LEED buildings from a bit more expensive to less expensive, takes solar from more expensive to less expensive. So we see examples there. We see City of Palo Alto, where a lot of the action has been in the municipal utility organization. But now, with me there as the Chief Sustainability Officer, we're going to be focusing much more on the comprehensive sustainability strategy for what is admittedly a small city. This is a 65,000-person community. but it's one with a tradition of being the spark plug of innovation. I mean, the HP garage that people talk about is two blocks from my office. It's still there. It's a national landmark as sort of the spark plug of Silicon Valley. So we have Palo Alto surrounded by Silicon Valley, surrounded by the San Francisco Bay Area, which is arguably one of the centers of excellence and innovation in the planet today. So we have a very interesting opportunity there, both to do what is remarkable for the citizens of Palo Alto, to improve quality of life and improve economic prosperity and improve the environment and reduce our footprint, and then do this in a way that hopefully provides inspiration and tools and teaching for the other communities in our neighborhood, who we're also learning from, and communities around the planet.
So I want to talk about you now as this relatively new position as the Chief Sustainability Officer for Palo Alto. You know, you're at the front edge of this great challenge. You know, you've been tasked with, you know, make Palo Alto the greenest city in America. How are you going to approach that challenge?
First of all, through a lot of conversation. You know, the greenest city in America thing is a bit of a funny line. As I said to the city council on my second day on the job, I said it's a bit of a challenging goal. Cause first of all, there got to be at least 20 other cities who are going after that brass ring.
That's, again, the kind of competition we want.
It's great competition, and I see that as a collaborative competition, learn from each other. But the other challenge there is that nobody knows what in the world that means to be the greenest city in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we get to do is start to have a conversation in the community, both within the city government and in the community as a whole, of like, you know, what does that mean to you? What do you want this community to be? What's the future vision for this community? What does greenest city in the country mean to you? What are the issues that we need to be thinking about? We've done great progress on our energy footprint. We've got a lot of challenging issues around transportation and land use, as I think many cities do. Some of these are technical challenges, and some of them are political and cultural. You know, do you do more density? Do you not do more density? What's the role of mass transit? How do you do this in a way that satisfies people's personal expectations as well as works economically and culturally? So I think there's no substitute for conversation, for engaging people in dialogue together about what do you really care about? What really matters to you? What opportunities do you see? We have the great gift, I'm going to say in Palo Alto, but I think this is true in many communities around the country, of residents and citizens who are passionate about these issues and very knowledgeable and are full of ideas, and some of our best suggestions have come from them. So really helping to turn up the dial on that process is one thing that I want to do. Second, we are going to build a coordinated strategy. As with a lot of communities, there's many initiatives underway. I'm a month into the job and still haven't mapped them all. But we're going to get all those visible, so that people know what's going on, they know what the pieces of the puzzle are, and we'll start to put that together into a coherent 10-year plan and a strategic roadmap that delineates issue by issue, function by function, year by year, what it is we're going to do, what are the goals we're going to shoot for, what has to happen, how are we going to get there. And tip of the hat back to my friend Jan Hanhart, the Dutch engineer, who drove radical innovation in his factory by making performance results visible to his employees. We'll find some way to build dashboards and scoreboards so that both people within City Hall and people in the community can say, oh, I see how we're doing on this issue that I care about, whether it's carbon footprint or water quality or gridlock or vehicle miles. I see what's going on. I see who's working on that. I see suggestions about what I can do to contribute to that. So it's really the challenge for me, and I think for anybody in this kind of position, is to find ways to leverage ourselves. There's no way, you know, I'm a staff of one right now with no budget yet. I have no authority to command anybody to do anything, which is probably just as well. But I have the opportunity to help focus a conversation, raise people's awareness about the examples and possibilities that have already been shown, get a clearer perspective on where our priorities can be and where our biggest leverage can be, and then help make the process and the results of that visible as widely as possible, knowing that, you know, like most communities, but certainly in this one, which is the hotbed of innovation, that that will spark innovations that we can't even think of today.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, I look forward to having you back. We can talk about more as you get deeper into that role, but it sounds like you're well on your way to helping Palo Alto and the country here. We just have a couple of minutes left, and before we sign off, I want to ask you, you know, you talk about what the citizens of Palo Alto can do. What do you think our listeners can do to support this sustainability revolution?
Well, certainly one thing that everybody can do is put your money where your heart is. You know, spend money in a way that reflects your values. Make purchasing decisions that encourage more of what you want and that discourage what you don't want. Second is to be active in the political process in whatever way that makes sense to you, whether it's running for office or organizing for campaigns or, you know, being an Occupy or Tea Party or wherever your inclination takes you, be active. And in that, I know a lot of my colleagues will disagree with me on this. You know, I think it's really valuable to be talking across the aisle. And that may be hard to do in Congress these days, but it is not as hard to do in neighborhoods. And you have organizations ranging from John Marks at Search for Common Ground to Joan Blades, formerly of Move On, who are building living room conversations to bring together neighbors who are on the right and left of the political spectrum to have coffee together and talk together and find where there is common ground within the differences. Because in my experience, there always is. I'll go out on the limb and say there always is. And it's hard to find that when there's a microphone or a camera stuck in your face. But in the privacy of a living room, it may be possible to do that. And there's an opportunity to build something new together. And then third, at a very different level, this is not something individuals can do, but it's something individuals can talk about and ask about, is that we have to get the prices right.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the prices that we pay for things lie to us about the real value of things, we're never going to get out of this box. And, you know, this is not, at a certain level, this is fancy economics, but at a very basic level, we know this. Look, we pay $3.50 to $4 a gallon for gas in California, in the Bay Area right now. I don't know what you're paying in the East, but, you know, somewhere up there, more mm-hmm. than we would have imagined 10 years ago, right?
Yep.
But if you look at the real cost of gasoline delivered to the pump in the United States, it's somewhere between $10 and $20 if you factor in all the costs and all the unmonetized externalities. So the question is for your listeners, if you had to pay, let's say, $15 a gallon for gasoline, would you be driving the car you're driving today? And I think it's an instant answer for everybody. Of course you wouldn't. And then the question is, if we were paying $15 a gallon for gasoline, would anybody be making the car that you're driving today? And the answer is also no, of course they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the places to put political and market pressure is on that question of how do we get the prices right? How do we pull the subsidies out from destructive practices and actually let the market work more effectively without the distortions that subsidies enforce on it? So I would say those three things. Put your money where your heart is, be active in the political process, however that is meaningful for you, and add your voice to the demand that we get the prices right and remove the distortions that won't let the market work effectively.
Fabulous. I love it. That is all the time we have. I just want people to know, for listeners, you can learn more about this important work that Gilfriend is doing with his Twitter handles, at Palo Alto CSO, and also at GFriend. So, Gilfriend, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for all your important work.
Eleanor, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Look forward to having you back soon.
That'll be great. I look forward to it, too.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.